I'm Dr. Howie Jacobson, and this is the Plant Yourself Podcast. Each week, I bring you a conversation with someone who's making a positive difference in the world. And for my day job, I help leaders and their teams master their mindsets so they can achieve great things. To find out more, check out the Mindset Mastery Memo, my Substack newsletter. You can find it at plantyourself.com/memo. And now, today's show. I'm Dr. Howie Jacobson, and this is the Plant Yourself Podcast. Each week, I bring you a conversation with someone who's making a positive difference in the world. And for my day job, I help leaders and their teams master their mindsets so they can achieve great things. To find out more, check out the Mindset Mastery Memo, my Substack newsletter. You can find it at plantyourself.com/memo. And now, today's show. Thanks for joining me for the Plant Yourself Podcast. I'm your host, Howie Jacobson. I've known today's guest since 1977 when Jocelyn Zuckerman and I met in seventh grade at South Orange Junior High. And we were in most of the same classes for 6 years, 3 years in junior high and 3 years in high school. And we went our separate ways, and we reconnected a decade ago at a high school reunion. And I was fascinated to see that Jocelyn was working on really hard-hitting, important investigative journalism around food and our culture of food and food supplies. And then I saw on LinkedIn, I believe, that she'd had a book published called Planet Palm, and it's about palm oil and palm kernel oil. And the subtitle of the book is How Palm Oil Ended Up in Everything and Endangered the World. And I bought the book and I started reading it, and I was so impressed with the scholarship that went into it. The first third is all about sort of the history of European discoveries of palm oil, which is to say exploitation of native peoples, native lands, native cultures where palm and palm oil had been a staple. And the history and the hard history of colonialism. And then moving into chapters about what's going on today? Palm oil and poverty, palm oil and ecological destruction, palm oil and its effects on the health of those who are consuming it, which is largely the poorest people in the world, since it's a very inexpensive and easy crop to grow. And my admission here is that it took me a really long time to read the book. Of course, a friend of mine writes an amazing book related to food and health and environment. Of course, I want to get her on the show right away. And I ordered the book the day that I saw it, and it took me almost a year to finish it. And to explain why, I'm going to read a bit of the first blurb on the back of the hardcover by Ruth Reichel, who wrote Tender at the Bone and My Kitchen Year. She says, Jocelyn Zuckerman has crossed the globe and looked back in time to show us how much the appetite for palm oil profit has cost us in human suffering, environmental degradation, and loss of biodiversity. This extraordinary work of investigative journalism will make you cry and gnash your teeth. It will fill you with rage. And then she goes on to say, it's essential reading for everyone who wonders if their food choices matter, but I really got hung up with crying, gnashing my teeth, and being filled with rage. It was just more than I could handle, except a few pages at a time. And which led me to realize the courage and the tenacity and the gift that Jocelyn has brought the world by not, you know, I just read it and it ruined me. She had to live it, traveling around the world for years and years, funding it through writing articles for different publications, and unflinchingly looking at and telling this really important story. So I am so thrilled that I finally finished it and that I got to have this wonderful conversation and reconnection with the author. So without further ado, Jocelyn Zuckerman, welcome to the Plant Yourself podcast.
Thank you so much. I'm thrilled to be here with you.
Yeah. So we haven't seen each other for about a decade almost.
And before that, probably 3 decades.
Yeah, we go way back. Right? South Columbia High School and I think South Orange Junior High too.
Yeah, I think we go back to 7th grade.
Yeah.
I think we're in all the same classes.
Yep. And of course, since you were a girl, I was intimidated by you. So we probably didn't speak much.
Since you were so smart, I was intimidated by you.
Oh, well, so we both bring baggage to our conversation.
We had a lot of classes together. I think we were in like math and history classes together for years.
Yeah. Right? Yep.
Miss O'Flaherty, we were in English class together.
I don't think I had Miss O'Flaherty.
You didn't Miss O'Flaherty?
Really? No. Was that junior high?
That was junior high, yeah. I thought you were in that class.
Gosh, maybe. I can't remember who I did have, so it's possible.
She was a former nun. She was really badass, but she was very good in terms of teaching us grammar and writing.
Oh, maybe so.
I think you were in that class.
Is that the one where the drama teacher came and had us read a poem?
As You Like It?
I think we had to pick a poem to perform.
I'm not sure. Mrs. Curtin, you were certainly in that. You were in the Continental Congress with us, right?
Yep, 2 years of Mrs. Curtin. Yeah, as I reflect, we were strangely well-educated.
We were. We had some good classes. And those AP history classes were good, I think.
Right.
Mr. Little. Mr. Yep. Spear.
Can you imagine those guys teaching today with the kind of
there was
surveillance and oversight and anti-wokeness?
Yeah. Right, totally. I know. We have a friend who's who was a teacher in New York City. Very lefty guy, but he said it's just like everyone's so paranoid about everything that they're saying that it's just gotten to be a very fraught environment, which is kind of a shame. But
yeah.
I mean, maybe also good that people's feelings are being taken into consideration that were never taken into consideration in the past, right?
Right. Well, you know, that's almost a segue to your book, which I don't think could be taught in most public schools in most states, because it tries to tell the truth about colonialism and you know, the history of the last, you know, 200-300 years in a way that, like, it's really hard to read. It's hard to argue with. So maybe we should just give our listeners a little context. You wrote this book, I guess, about a year ago. It came out now, called Planet Palm: How Palm Oil Ended Up in Everything and Endangered the World. Before we get into it, maybe, you know, tell us about your life since high school. Just give us a, you know, introduce yourself to my listeners.
Okay. So I went to college in upstate New York at Hamilton College. I studied English and French literature. I spent my junior year in Paris studying French literature at the Sorbonne. Huh. Came back, and after college, I taught English for a year, high school students, English, in Hoboken, New Jersey, actually, for a year. And then I moved to magazines and had a couple jobs at being an editor and writing for magazines. At a certain point, I thought about Peace Corps when I was in college, but I felt like I wanted to see if I could sort of make it in the workforce first. So when I was 26, I thought, okay, I want to do this. So I went to, ended up in Kenya with the Peace Corps, lived in a little village for 2 years teaching English and math. So that, I think the seeds of this book, Planet Palm, are really in that time, because it was an agricultural community. It was very sort of poor, remote, and just kind of opened my eyes to the way that most of the world lives. Came back from there thinking that I wanted to be an African correspondent, so I went to journalism school at Columbia, and then came out of there. Had since gotten involved with a guy who would become my husband, who was not interested in moving to anywhere in Africa, basically. So I sort of shifted to sort of cultural reporting, and I ended up at Gourmet Magazine, where I was for 12 years as an editor. It was great. At a certain point, Ruth Reichel came on as the editor-in-chief. She had been the food critic for the New York Times, and she was sort of an old hippie. She had lived in a commune in Berkeley. And just, Gourmet, when I first went there, had been sort of this old, little bit uptight magazine, Condé Nast magazine, very kind of formulaic for a wealthier audience. And Ruth came, and she really sort of opened up, you know, what a food magazine could do. And so we got to do much more political stuff. I got to bring on a bunch of great writers. And so I was there for 12 years, ended as deputy editor, and finally left only, I mean, it was a great place, but only because I sort of felt like I wasn't learning that much anymore. And I wanted to get back to sort of more environmental stuff, more political stuff. So I went freelance with a couple stints at magazines. I worked at a magazine called On Earth, which was published by the Natural Resources Defense Council. So I worked there as an editor for about a year, and then I worked as a writer for them. I also worked at Modern Farmer, which is a magazine. I think it's now only online, but it was a good magazine for a while. Anyway, then focused on freelance writing. And one of the pieces I did was I pitched it to that magazine On Earth about land grabs, and I went to report it in Liberia. Got down on the ground and saw that all this land grabbing had to do with palm oil. And several years later, I published the book, and here we are.
Right. Hey, just your audio is coming in a little soft for me. I don't know if there's anything you can do to
I don't know. What do I do?
I don't know, either a knob or a button, or closer to the microphone, or shout. if not, I'm sure we can.
We can
do something in post.
Is this better? You know, actually, that there was one comment on that Adam Ragusea YouTube thing saying that my sound was really bad. I don't know why. It's a MacBook Pro. It's a couple years older.
I don't know. Just, you know, maybe a little closer to the microphone, and we definitely want
okay,
to platform
I've
you.
Just moved in.
Okay. Great.
Now my head's more on your level.
Yeah, I mean, I can definitely hear you, so I'm sure I can equalize somehow. But
yeah, it doesn't look like that. I don't know what to do. Sorry.
Okay. Well, I just project. Okay. Mr. Schertzer, that was the guy who was teaching us how to recite poetry.
Oh, I didn't have him.
Oh, he just came in for 2 weeks in some English teacher's class. We stopped doing sentence diagramming, and we did.
Oh, sentence diagramming! Forgot that was.
Yeah, Warreners. All right. Well, the mind is the middle-aged mind is doing amazing things. So you open the book with the story of reporting that land grab in Liberia. And you mentioned that you start the book in a way that you didn't dare to start the magazine article, which is Kurt Cobain's song "Rape Me,"
right,
playing in your ears as a kind of an organizing metaphor for what you saw.
Yeah.
So what did you see?
And it was absolutely true. I really did. It was so brutal what I was seeing. That really was the song that was pounding in my head. But I knew my editors would just be like, come on, Jocelyn, enough with the. The rape metaphor, but I just saw this landscape that was devastated, and there's a picture in the book. They just cut down this oil palm company had cut down tropical rainforest for miles and miles. I mean, it was just like a wasteland. And the people I talked to said, you know, we've lived here for generations. We got our fish and our water and our hunted for small animals and all of our vegetables and fruits and our building materials, everything from the forest, and now it's gone. Now we're just marooned here. What do we do? Get jobs with the oil palm company, which were not well paid and kind of brutal in every way.
Right, and you said you wrote, you know, that article, and you after you published it, you wondered, like, had you missed a bigger picture? Were you overdoing the talk about palm oil? Maybe this was a an anomaly. What did you do? Right. What did you do then? Because like one of the things I just want to say about the book is that it was really hard for me to read. And I say that not in a way that I want to discourage other people from reading it, but it's, you know, you discuss a lot of brutal stuff, and I can't even imagine what it must have been to write. And, but at some point you're like, I've got to explore this in detail. What did you then do to start the whole process of researching this book?
So, yeah, I mean, I felt so strong about the whole thing coming back from that Liberia trip. But, yeah, I thought, you know, I'm sort of this parachuting in journalist. You know, I'm based in New York. And could I have missed the bigger picture, or could this have been, as you said, an anomaly? So I started basically pitching, I didn't know I was going to do a book at that point. But I thought this palm oil stuff is very interesting and sort of nobody's talking about it. So I started pitching magazine stories to other magazines so that mainly I would get myself to Indonesia and Malaysia. And because that's the, for your listeners, 85% of the palm oil today is produced in Indonesia and Malaysia. So I wanted to get over there and, see what it looked like in that context and talk to workers and talk to villagers. And and I saw basically the same thing. And then I got myself to Guatemala and Brazil, Honduras, and was hearing the same stories over and over. So I felt like, okay, I don't think I got that Liberia story wrong. And in fact, this is probably a bigger story than I even realized.
So let's have a little background for people before we get into the story. So what is palm oil?
So palm oil is an oil that comes from the oil palm tree. And the oil palm is indigenous to West and Central Africa. There's an oil palm fruit. It's about this big. It's about the shape of a plum, but it's like bright, can be yellow. It's mostly orange, can be sort of yellow to red. And you get actually two oils from it. So there's this orange fleshy material from which you get palm oil. And then there's a white kernel. And from that, you get another oil called palm kernel oil. It's been used traditionally in Africa for cooking, for sort of rubbing on the body, for lighting lamps. They tap the sap to make palm wine. They use the leaves for building. But it's really since the turn of the century that it has been commoditized. And in particular, as I said, in Southeast Asia, the plant brought from Africa over to Southeast Asia. Produced on these huge plantations, and then sort of has found its way into something like 50% of every product on U.S. grocery store shelves.
Mm-hmm. Right. So you begin the first part of the book called Unguent of Empire. It's the first time I've read the word unguent since Latin class. Why did you decide to dive into the history as opposed to like what a journalist might do is just talk about what's going on now? What was the relevance for you?
I didn't really know that I was going to do that when I started, you know, looking into this, but then I started reading it and I was just fascinated because I had no idea. I had no idea that, as I talk about in the book, basically the slave trade, the infrastructure that was put in place for the slave trade in the Niger Delta, was then used to trade palm oil. And that palm oil was this really important commodity in the 19th century. And I was fascinated basically on what I was finding. And then there were also some really interesting characters involved in the trade. I talk about George Goldie mainly, this aristocratic British guy who got involved, basically went down and supplanted all the African traders in palm oil. And then this other guy, William Lever, who was the founder of what would become Unilever, which is still, I think, the biggest buyer of palm oil in the world. Mm-hmm. So basically, I was fascinated by what I was reading, and I thought other people would be interested in this, I hope.
Yeah, and you know, as I was then reading the contemporary stories, the echoes of the past were really, really loud. Right. Like, it hasn't changed.
Plus ça change, I say at one point in the
book. Yeah. So, you know, George Goldie's a fascinating guy. He comes across originally as sort of this foppish ne'er-do-well, but you do point out he did have a brilliance to him. And it's
you know, it's kind of a sick joke that this guy was kind of ill-equipped for anything other than, oh, colonizing Africa and rationalizing, from a Western point of view, the palm oil trade.
And he didn't even live there. He went there once, and then he, I guess he went there twice. He went there at the end of his career, but he did this all from London. He was just sort of puppeteering from London, and so not seeing the result of his machinations.
Yeah, so he created the UAC, right? Then the NAC, and finally the Royal Niger Constabulary. And you know, reading about like the attacks, it kind of reminded me of the worst brutality of the rubber trade. Here in
very, very similar,
right? Like, okay, so the story is he goes in, or his people go in, take whatever they want, and use every lever, including horrific violence and threats of violence, to essentially enslave an entire population because they have no choice.
Right. Well, he also had guys agents who were going around and sort of coercing chiefs and kings into signing away, often, you know, plying them with alcohol first and then signing contracts in languages that they didn't understand, which were basically signing over, yes, my territory will be a free trade zone. And then he basically bought off all the traders that were working there so that he had this monopoly and, basically kicked them out of their own trade.
And, you know, he reminded me kind of like a lot of sort of Silicon Valley entrepreneurs who are like, oh, I see an inefficient system. I'm going to go in and make it more efficient without, you know, and I don't want to compare like Airbnb and Uber to what he did. But this idea, like, we're not even going to think about collateral damage to human beings because, all I'm thinking about is extractive efficiency.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, that's the story of the palm oil industry, really. And then William Lever did the same thing in the Belgian Congo. When it went in saying like, oh, I'm, you know, King Leopold was so bad, but I'm coming in after, I'm a Christian, I'm going to build churches, I'm going to build schools. And there was a little of that, but a lot of it was sort of smoke and mirrors. And then when people got down to actually report on it, they said it's little improved from the days of King Leopold.
Yeah, and that was shocking to be able to trace this guy and this company's wealth to such ill-gotten gains. I guess I've been sort of sensitized recently by the coverage around the death of the Queen and discussions of the royal
empire.
Fortune and empire and where it came from. And it's an unbroken line. It's the 50s, 60s, 80s. We're still doing it. We're still
totally. I know. And you just realize how recent that history was. And as I say in the book, how history's drumbeats reverberate. Like not only is it sort of echoing into what we're seeing today, but actually the ramifications of what was happening in those times, two or three generations down, both the people who accumulated the wealth, and both the people who are screwed, their families are reaping the benefits and the damage of that today.
So one of the interesting bits was sort of how palm oil changed a Europe that was ready to be changed by it, from the lubrication, the idea, the Industrial Revolution needed lubrication and it needed soap. Mm-hmm. And just like, these sort of, it looks like sort of weird historical coincidences that were made possible.
And then needed lots of processed food. That's a joke. It didn't need it, but they found a way to, I mean, I guess there were growing populations and to make this cheap food that you could get out to people there again, palm oil was at the ready.
Right. So I guess the historical part ends around the sort of end of the 20th century in Malaysia, where you talk about like the tree cover loss. And
yeah. Do you have the stat?
I have 20 million acres of tree cover lost in the last 20 years, like as of.
Yeah. Have you ever flown over Indonesia or Malaysia?
I haven't.
Landed in either place. It's just devastating. There's some pictures in the book. I mean, you just fly for miles and miles and you just see, it's either these sort of graphic, square matrices of the plantations or if it's hilly, they sort of curve around. But it's just, as I said, you can fly really for hours, and that's all you see. You know, maybe little bits of towns in between there, or little, you know, factories, but it's just oil palm everywhere.
Mm. And when you compare it to historical photos, what's the difference?
Oh, it used to be, you know, tropical rainforest, just dense foliage. Mm. I mean, in the meantime, there was rubber in that part of the world as well. So a lot of the oil palm plantations did replace rubber. But since there's been just continued massive deforestation for oil palm. Mm.
So one of the things you write in the book is you want, I think in the prologue, is to, you want to hand the narrative to those without voices. Mm-hmm. So I would love to just share some of the stories of some of the people that you've, you know, interviewed and featured, and kind of put their stories in the historical perspective. So one of them is, I guess, Yoki Hadi Prakarsa.
Uh-huh. He's the hornbill specialist. I didn't actually meet him. We just communicated remotely from Indonesia. But so as I said earlier, I sort of pitched magazine stories as a way to help, you know. So this is before I had done the proposal for the book. So I pitched magazine stories as a way to subsidize these research trips and to get deeper and deeper into the subject matter. And I learned about these helmeted hornbills, which are these amazing birds with this big casque on top of their heads. That it's like this, the same, I guess, is it keratin? Would it be keratin? It's the same, very similar to ivory, like to elephant tusk ivory. So it's prized particularly among the Chinese for sort of carving into trinkets and jewelry and things. Anyway, so Yoki is an expert in these birds, and these birds are, you know, they live in tropical rainforests. There's a bunch of different species that live in Southeast Asia. There's a couple that live in Africa, but they're mostly in Southeast Asia. Some of the guys that I pitched a story to Audubon magazine, the magazine about birds, to go look at what's happening with the species of bird being critically endangered and how that was linked to the palm oil industry. So Yoki was sort of my expert who helped me navigate that. But the other people that I hung out with when I was over there for that trip were these guys who, these poachers who shot the helmeted hornbills down. Forgive me for one second. I've got a dog begging to get in. Come on. You have to be quiet. Sorry.
That's okay.
The children were supposed to keep the dogs away, but so much for that. Anyway, so I hung out. There was a guy named Rudy Putra, who mm-hmm. was who grew up in Sumatra, and he, as a young kid, he was sort of enthralled by some of the big animals that live in Sumatra, among them the Sumatran orangutan, rhinoceros, tiger, and elephant. And he saw that they were being poached. They were also losing their habitat largely to oil palm plantations. So he sort of dedicated his life to saving them, both in terms of working with the people who were poaching and trying to help them finding alternate livelihoods. And so I was spending time with him. He also took me into a part of the rainforest that hadn't been cut down to sort of see how things used to be there and why it was so important to save this landscape and its incredible biodiversity. But he had interacted with some of these guys who were poaching the birds. And so he arranged somehow for these guys to come and talk to me about what they were doing. And yeah, it was kind of devastating. The one guy came in with his big gun. He was, as I said, he sort of made this cocky entrance. He thought he seemed like, you know, he thought he was very cool. But, and they talked just matter-of-factly about, yes, we shoot down these birds. We know they're critically endangered, but we have to feed our families. We don't have any other livelihood. This was in the northern part of Sumatra, Aceh, where there was a civil war for a long time. So a lot of people didn't get schooling. And so, yeah, I end that chapter talking about, one of them said, you know, we would like to do anything else. It's not that we want to kill these birds. It's just that we know we could sell them for a lot of money. And one of them said that he had had his gun modified because the 4mm bullets that it normally shot didn't always kill the birds on contact. and that it just broke their hearts to see the bird suffer. So he had paid money to have it modified so it would shoot a bigger bullet, so he could make sure that when he hit the birds that they would die, so that he didn't have to watch them suffer.
If you hadn't brought that up, I was going to mention it, because I reread, skimmed the book this morning in preparation for our conversation, and when I got to that part, which I hadn't remembered from my previous reading, I cried. Like this poacher is, you know, sort of evil poacher, right? The one who's killing the endangered species is like
just trying to feed his kids.
Feed his kids and willing to spend some of his money in an act of mercy. And you realize like boy, pointing fingers is a hard thing. And we're very likely to be pointing fingers in the wrong directions if we don't understand, you know, the global picture that you portray here.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, and I think, you know, that YouTube piece, I can't remember his first name, Ragusea.
Adam Ragusea.
He sort of ends it by saying, like, let's not live in moral superiority by having a very easy judgment of what's going on. You know, it's like, you know, being part of the Western industrialized world, like, you know, we have a lot to answer for, as opposed to like just going around the world and pointing fingers at what all the other people are doing wrong.
Exactly. Yeah. And also who's using all that palm oil? I mean, they use some there now, but it's like the lion's share of those processed foods, you know, a lot of it's landing with us, with people in Western countries.
Right. So you talk about something that happened in Indonesia in October of 1965, a kind of uprising or massacre, a laborers' revolt that was like really put down by Suharto,
right? With the help of the CIA, right?
Right, Sukarno was kind of, you know, like communist friendly, even though the Communist uh-huh. Party there had been illegal for a while, but the CIA does not want, you know, communist governments in charge of
workers revolting, right?
Right, and you know,
so that was an interesting thing in the book, and it was similar. I talk about in Honduras, you know, where the a lot of the palm oil is grown on former land that was bananas grown by Chiquita before that United Fruit. So there was, you know, CIA involvement there too. I found it kind of fascinating. You talk about pointing fingers, and then, you know, in so many of these instances, you can go back and see that the United States was in there, you know, doing its thing.
Yeah, and you know, if you saw like last week, you know, when the you could pay $8 for a blue check on Twitter, somebody went in and
I saw that.
Was it Chiquita Banana? We've just like overthrown the government of.
Exactly. Yeah. I got a kick out of that.
Right. So at that point, now, you know, so we've got the CIA implicated in, you know, through very good sources, but now the World Bank, which is, you know, devoted, mm-hmm. dedicated to ending global poverty, I believe, is their mission. What do they do?
Well, the current president denies climate change, so that give you some idea about, you know, how far-reaching and inclusive their mindset was. But so, I mean, you know, in their defense, it's like you can't always see, you know, what's going to result from the measures you take in the future. But the idea was to help alleviate poverty. So when Indonesia and Malaysia gained their independence, they had these big populations of very poor people. So they gave out parcels of land and oil palm seedlings and rubber seedlings to help these peasants, you know, have an income, grow this stuff and have an income. But then it just kept sort of multiplying, and this commodity became central to both of their economies, not realizing the impact that it would have on the environment and on their diets and on biodiversity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right about like what the traditional subsistence diet would have been, and you know, aside from like, you know, the boar, I think I would have enjoyed all of it. you know. So,
right, lots of roots and seeds and greens, fruits, all sorts of fruits. Right. Yeah.
But you know, it was very similar to sort of like dessert, you know, dessert economies all over the world, from bananas to pineapples to coffee. That right, we get all this cheap stuff, and the people who are living there can't afford it, and no longer, you know, now they're eating, you know, ramen and white flour products because all of their right. subsistence
and state subsidized rice. Yeah. Yeah. Lots of junk food. As I said, in the sort of a lot of these oil palm plantations, there would be little villages that were just marooned in the middle of them because the companies had just sort of bought up or stole all the land around. And it's so many of these little villages, there would be a little like bodega type place with just garbage food, you know, all this fried chips and crispy things and sweets and cigarettes. There was nothing, there was no fresh fruits or vegetables in these places. So the diets were just really garbage.
Hmm. And, you know, in chapter 6, Caravan Dreams, like the poor diet is sort of the least of people's health concerns. You open the chapter by talking about Walter Bonagus.
Mm-hmm.
Could you tell a little bit about him?
So he was a worker in Honduras for that company, Grupo Harimar, which was a it incorporated, I think, part of what used to be Chiquita, if I'm correct. Anyway, it's on land. They're farming oil palm on land that used to be Chiquita bananas. So these I talked about sort of the oil palm fruits. They grow in these big bunches way up in the canopy of the oil palm fruits. And people used to sort of shimmy up there and take a machete and knock them down. These days they use these long aluminum poles to bonk these big bunches of fruit down. So he was doing that, and he sort of slid into, I can't remember if it had rained or if they just watered the plants. Anyway, he got electrocuted using this thing. So when I met him, one of his arms sort of cut off here, and he had like skin grafts and scars all over his chest and his legs. His friends, I talked to some friends who had been with him, and they said he just like exploded in a ball of fire. And they were in the middle of the plantation, so they didn't have any vehicles there. They had to like flag somebody down to get a car and then get him to a clinic and then to an actual hospital where they could handle all these like very intense bruises. So I talk about that, and then just there's a lot of other health issues that come with working these jobs. They're around harsh chemicals, paraquat, and what's the Roundup one?
Yeah, glyphosate.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So they're handling these harsh chemicals. They say they've got stinging eyes, skin issues. The women in Indonesia have been documented that they've got collapsed uteruses from carrying these heavy fruit bunches and sacks of oil palm fruits. So, you know, not just health issues. Then they also said there's like the company is so cheap that it won't pay for enough workers to sort of clean up around the trees. So you get snakes in that undergrowth, and some of them are issued boots, but they said they're these cheap boots that the snakes can bite right through. So some of them have died from snake bites. And so they tried to organize against Grupo Harimar, and then a lot of them were harassed or fired for trying to, get better concessions from the company.
Yeah, you talked about the like the PPE that was sort of given that either doesn't fit or doesn't work, or actually, you know, the gloves that are made of natural materials that kind of soak it up and make things worse.
Right. And the goggles, they said you try these on. You can't wear them in like 80 degree heat. They get all fogged up. You can't do the job that you're meant to do with the kind of goggles that they gave them.
And you know, in the same chapter, you talk about human trafficking of people to the Malaysian plantations, because the Malaysian people, by and large, are too well off to want to do that work.
Right, and a much smaller population than Indonesia. So yeah, they get people in from some of the Indonesian islands, from Myanmar, India, Bangladesh, and you know, in some cases they want to come and get these jobs, but in many cases it's sort of coerced labor and they come under false pretenses and they can have their passports confiscated and put up in just horrific conditions. And basically, yeah, trapped there. Like, they don't have identification papers, so they can't get out.
All right. And you also talk about child labor, sexual abuse. These are extremely marginalized and disempowered people.
Mm. And so remote. I mean, I also talk about, so that Liberia story, it was like 8 hours to get to the plantations on really awful roads. And the same, you know, so much of my reporting in all these places was just like driving on these really bad roads to get to these very remote places. And that's partly why, as I say in the book, why the industry can get away with this, because, you know, there's just a real lack of oversight, because who's going to get out there? It's not, you know, journalists on occasion, sort of watchdog groups on occasion, but that workers told me in Honduras and Indonesia, like, oh yeah, they know when they're coming, we can talk about, there's something called the Roundtable on Sustainable Palm Oil, which is supposed to monitor the industry. And they say, yeah, oh, they you know, the company knows when the inspectors are coming. So they hide us like way back there, or they tell us this is what we're supposed to say. So, you know, a lot goes on that is not known about unless somebody's like really making an effort to get there and like spend a lot of time there, which also isn't easy because there's guards on these plantations and, you know, the workers are being intimidated. So they're afraid to talk to journalists, and it's complicated. Mm-hmm.
All right. And you talk about a 2015 Wall Street Journal article on the conglomerate FGV, which, you know, the issue from, you know, from my perspective as a consumer is I don't want to participate in a supply chain that involves sexual abuse, child labor, slavery, trafficking, you know, union busting, intimidation. And yet you talk about the palm oil is, you know, we can trace it pretty much to Nestle, Johnson & Johnson, Colgate, mm-hmm. Palmolive, Procter & Gamble, Kellogg's, Mars, Pepsi, L'Oreal, ADM, Cargill, like companies that are just, you know, everywhere in our lives. That there's very little supply chain transparency.
Yeah, and it takes a lot of effort on the consumer's part to, you know, to go in and track. I mean, I did it for my reporting, but to go in and track, like, what mill is this going to, and then what refinery, and then where do those exports go to? FGV, in fact, the U.S. government a year ago, 2 years ago, stopped imports of palm oil from FGV, Feldenko Global Ventures, specifically on labor abuse charges. So I don't think that's been reinstated. I haven't checked, but so there were reports on that, credible reports, and so they. The Border Patrol said, we're not getting imports from this company anymore. So something.
And the other way I feel personally implicated as an American is, you know, in the history of United Fruit and the CIA, they hired the propaganda guy, right? Edward Bernays, to convince us that the fruit company and the, you know, were the good guys, and these laborers, peasant laborers, were the bad guys.
Uh-huh. Which, same thing. I mean, there's one of the big companies in Honduras, Dinant. I get emails from their PR guy all the time telling me about all the great stuff they're doing. And these guys were, they were implicated in many deaths in maybe 2015. There was lots of clashes with the peasants there. And, in fact, the World Bank had been loaning them money and then cut it off because of these very credible reports of murders by their guards and other folks connected with the company. And then, as I say in the book, so the Malaysian palm oil industry is somehow more aggressive than the Indonesian one. I guess it's sort of a hangover from history, but they are like, they go after critics very strongly, and they tend to call them neo-colonialists. Like, who are you to tell us poor people, you know, what to do? And then in the course of my reporting, I learned that this whole campaign about the neo-colonialists had been, it was a U.S. lobbying firm, PR firm in D.C. that had come up with this campaign and was being paid more than $1 million to do it. So, you know, the whole campaign is like, how can you tell us what to do? And you're discounting, you know, the livelihoods of all these smallholder farmers. So it's all about like, it's the poor smallholder farmers and who are you rich Western people to, you know, screw with their lives. But the fact is that these smallholder farmers are like living on the poverty line, if that, and the real money of the industry is very concentrated still in among, you know, like 10 big companies. The Indonesian ones in particular run by, you know, the next generation of folks who were Suharto cronies. So it's still that wealth is still very concentrated, and the power in the industry is still in the hands of a very few. So this idea that like it's the smallholders that are losing out if you, you know, criticize the industry is bullshit. You know, calculated by this PR firm in Washington D.C. lobbying firm.
Yeah. Well, one of the shocking anecdotes you share is you're at this conference on global health around, you know, obesity and chronic disease, and the Malaysian Minister of Health gives this rousing speech about bad diet, and then you want to interview him, and they say, oh, well, he can talk about everything except palm oil.
I couldn't believe it when the guy said that. Yeah. And then he just goes to me. I never got to interview him. He was like, no, she wants to talk about palm oil. He had been very friendly up until that.
Yeah. So how much of your access depended on you, for lack of a better word, lying about what you were writing about?
I didn't have to do, I mean, I did do it when I went undercover in Indonesia. I was with a group called Eyes on the Forest. And when I got there, somehow they were worried that we would get stopped, and I needed to be able to show people like why I was there. So I did pretend there. I went in to meet like the sort of municipal head. I don't know exactly what his title was, but I did go in with my binoculars, like saying that I was there to see the helmeted hornbills and the orangutans. Otherwise, I mean, I guess I was prepared to lie, but I didn't really have to, because I didn't I didn't always write journalists. Like if I had to get a visa, I just said I was going as a tourist, so mm-hmm. not sort of raise alarm bells. That's, you know, that's a tricky thing, because if you get caught, you're really screwed. But I guess that's it. I'm trying to remember in other places. I just tried to, you know, fly under the radar, basically.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, I was a little prepared to lie, but I really only did it in that instance in Sumatra.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk about the Eyes on the Forest and the person you call Wawan? Because as I was reading that part, I was like, boy, you could write like, you know, Tom Clancy style, you know, Robert Bourne, Robert Ludlum, like fiction, like this, like the things they had to go through. It felt like so like inside baseball about how to do this work. Can you talk about that?
So yeah, they've been at it a couple of years. The lead one in particular. So they go undercover. They pretend they're like, they work for maybe WWF, or that they're like, they want to buy land. I think they even will say that they work for the oil palm industry. So basically what they're trying to do is figure out who's growing oil palm in illegal places. Mostly it's like in national parks or on peatlands where you're not supposed to be planting it, or sort of close to a river, or on land that, you know, should be owned by a village, but a company's just sort of gone in and taken over. So they go in and pose as these in these various different guises. And I tell the story at one point, we're driving, again, this is in Sumatra, just like way far away from much of anything. And we saw a guy sitting next to his truck with all the oil palm fruits mounted up above. And we might have been, I think we were inside a national park at that point. So we knew that he had harvested them, or he had gotten them from somebody who'd harvested them inside the national park. So they just sort of, they pulled up and he went out, and this guy, as I said, he was kind of like he was a total mensch. These guys were like hunched over their computers half the time doing, and like figuring out their drones and getting photography. But also that out in the field, they just started like playing this game. So anyway, he walked up to the driver and he just started like small talking with him. He said like, is this where you see the tigers? And then he was like, oh, how's your how's your harvest? Where are you taking it? And the guy said, I'm taking it to, I think it was Tebow, like a town nearby. And he said, oh, I have an uncle who lives in Tebow. What's the guy's name, your trader? And then the guy, and he was like, that's the same name as my uncle. Like, you know, extracting all this. And meanwhile, the other guy's taking pictures of his license plate. And yeah, it was very funny to see, because when I said this guy was like very straight otherwise. And to just see him just start like, you know, totally lying and getting all this information. They were very clever. And that was another time we were stopped waiting for some other. So a lot of what I did with them was like basically track these trucks that were transporting the palm oil. So we would see if they were coming from inside a national park or some other restricted area, and then sort of try to follow them without seeing that we were following them. So at one point we were like, we knew this truck was there getting fruit from an illegal place. So we were just sort of staked out waiting for him, so then we could pull up behind him. But they said, you know, if anybody comes, you know, say we have a flat tire, or say we're having engine trouble, and we're just waiting for like somebody to come and help us. Yeah, they were amazing characters. And as I said, there were like five, I think it was five guys and or four guys and two drivers. All these guys Indonesian, didn't speak any English. There's one who spoke kind of a little English, and I couldn't hire my own fixer because this was all undercover and they didn't want to like anybody else. So I was just using their interpreter. We were together, I think, for like 4 or 5 days. So it was an adventure.
Wow. And you also talk about they have to change their shirts when they're on the motorcycle, right, and you had to swap out 4x4s and change license plates, like very right. James Bond, right?
Yeah, that's what I was saying. So as I said, they're riding behind these trucks, tracing them, but they don't want the trucks to know that they're the same guys. So yeah, they would change the color of their shirts and swap out the license plate swapping. I think was actually the guys who were driving the trucks, because they knew that, you know, they might be they were going to bring illegal fruit to a certain mill or something, and they didn't want to be caught, so they would change the license plates, I think, if I remember correctly.
Gotcha. And was your family worried about you on these trips, or did you like not tell them everything?
I didn't tell them everything, but it's very funny because my son, who's a senior in high school, I'm working on something else right now. And about 2 weeks ago, I said, did I tell you that I'm taking a trip for work? And he said, no, where are you going? I said, well, I'm going to Brussels and Paris and Prague. And he started cracking up and he said, I love how your travel has changed. It used to be like, I'm going undercover in Honduras and there's like a 60% chance that I'll get murdered. Now I'm going to Paris and Prague. So I guess they sort of knew. It was that Honduras trip, which I canceled it like two different times because I was just like, I didn't feel like I had all the pieces in place in terms of security. And yeah, I was just like, Honduras and Guatemala are kind of scary places to go. I mean, you know, you can go to Guatemala, tourist areas, I think are pretty safe, but where I was in both of those places were a little scary, as I say in the book, because a lot of it is bound up with the drug trade. Mm-hmm. So I think life is pretty cheap in those places. So they sort of knew. I would kind of downplay it when I was at those places, I think. But maybe when I came home, I'd say that was scary.
Mm-hmm. Why did you do it?
I really thought like nobody knows about this stuff, and it's everywhere. I really, as I said, like in that time in the Peace Corps, I lived in this little village right on the equator, and then I went to Liberia and saw this. It was also little villages right on the equator, looked very similar to mine, and I just thought like all these people are getting screwed and it's also like screwing public health, and it's screwing the environment, you know, both in terms of biodiversity, climate change. I really felt like it matters. And you know, it's nice to do work that you think matters. It was really interesting.
Okay, good. Yeah, because I mean, I kept, as I was reading it, I kept on trying to think about what it must have been like for you to write it. And I think it was easier for me to do that because I know you, right? It wasn't just like, oh, some author, like, oh, this is a real person who like went through, like, first of all, the pain of having to read about things you didn't see, and then putting yourself in danger and witnessing like tragedy after tragedy.
Yeah. It's, I mean, as I also say in the book, you know, I came home to Brooklyn, you know, to, so, you know, lucky me that I get to live this sort of safe, privileged life, but a lot of people don't. And as I said, it was definitely the time in Peace Corps that made me think like, oh shit, this is like how most of the world lives and nobody knows. And like, we're just living our lives blindly, doing the things we do and not realizing like how it's impacted people on the other side of the planet. So it was kind of, you know, a privilege to be able to do something that I felt like, you know, benefited, like, if not the people in my village, those kinds of people who, you know, as I say, like, don't generally get much of a voice.
Mm-hmm. So chapter 10 has some good news, right? Uh-huh. The fight the power. So you talk about the Girl Scout activists, because those two girls seem to have done more than almost anyone.
I know. Amazing, right? So these Girl Scouts, I can't remember what year. It was a while ago, in the 80s, I think. Originally. Because that was the thing when I started, when I got this idea, I thought, like, palm oil, the only thing I remember is, like, something about Girl Scouts and orangutans. Did you remember that? Like, I had some idea in my head that I had remembered.
Yeah. No, that wasn't on my radar.
So these Girl Scouts were doing something to get a badge in, I don't know if it was biodiversity or something about the environment, I think. And so they had done like a research program, or maybe it was in orangutans. They'd done a research program on palm oil and its impact on the, I think, the habitat of the orangutans. They were, I think, like 14 at the time. I'm not positive. And then they started doing more research into palm oil, and they realized like, oh, palm oil is in all the Girl Scout cookies, which are made by Kellogg's, and these kids happen to be in Michigan. So then they started trying to like write letters to Kellogg's. They were a little bit ignored at first. Somehow they ended up hooking up with an organization called Mighty Earth in DC that sort of helped them. The organization was like, oh, we've got these adorable girls. They're talking about orangutans. They're talking about Girl Scout cookies. Like, you know, this is a way that we can finally get attention to this really important thing, like deforestation and tropical rainforests and climate change. So they sort of helped them, like gave them some media training, and I think helped them get hooked up with journalists. Anyway, then these girls were on Good Morning America and the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and People Magazine. And so got a lot of publicity. And then what happened was the guy from Mighty Earth and a guy from another organization, they had already been in talks with with Wilmar, the biggest oil palm trader based in Singapore. Trying to get the traders to say like, okay, we're not going to trade palm oil that's linked to deforestation. But they weren't really getting much traction. The guys were like, yeah, we'll do that. But then they were like, you know, you've got all these protesters now outside of Kellogg's, and, you know, Americans are starting to wake up to this, and your consumers, we can link this, you know, this stuff at Kellogg's to your company. And so you need to, so it was sort of the leverage that they had in saying, you know, people are waking up to this, and the companies that you're selling to are going to be screwed, and you're going to be stuck, you know, with no one to sell your palm oil to. So that sort of put the leverage on the traders, and then they signed like a no deforestation, no peat development on peat. What's the word I want? You know, they vowed not to do that anymore. So it was those Girl Scouts that, with the help of this other organization, sort of ended up being the perfect vehicle to like bring this message to the public.
Right, and you know, so given that message, and given the that deal between, I think, Glenn Horowitz and Kwok, I think was the person he was meeting with. Like again, we have the issue of supply chain, right? Like how confident are you that these aren't just, you know, words on paper?
Glenn Horowitz is, so that Mighty Earth, that organization, they have since started this thing, I forget what it's called, but they've got like satellites all over. It's like a rapid monitoring system. So they've got their eyes on like what's going on. And if they see deforestation, their idea was, if we get to the traders, like, you know, there are all these different palm oil companies, but they go through not that many traders that then distribute it to these companies. So they thought, if we can get the traders, you know, hold the traders' feet to the fire, then that's the way to sort of deal with it better. So what they do is, if they see deforestation, they get in touch with the trading companies that they know that palm oil is going to go to, and they say, you know, you need to cut that off immediately, or, you know, we're gonna do lots of media about how you're trading palm oil linked to deforestation and peat development. So I think they're doing a pretty good job, and it has had an impact on deforestation. That said, there is leakage. I mean, there are companies that just don't care, and they know, you know, maybe if they're not going to find their market in the States or in Europe, they can always find a market in China or Pakistan or India, where consumers aren't, you know, tend not to care as much about, tend not to have the, let's say, to have the luxury to care as much about, you know, environmental concerns or human rights concerns. So I think it's helped. I don't think it's like, you know, foolproof. It's not like tightly. Mm-hmm.
Well, in the epilogue, which you said, like, I didn't think I was going to write this epilogue, but the pandemic happened, and so let's talk about it. You know, you do offer ideas about what we can do, but like, palm oil is, you know, it's at the center of a lot, but it's also a symptom of of lots of other structures. Right. What you know, now two years on from the beginning of the pandemic, when you have a sort of a lot more perspective and hindsight, what do you think we need to do, both, you know, as you and me and people who are listening, as, you know, citizens and consumers, and what kind of policy changes could really make a difference?
I was very heartened to see, was it yesterday or the day before, finally, like, developed countries said, okay, we're gonna help, you know, fund poor countries being impacted by climate change. I think the same thing needs to happen. It started to happen a little bit, but in a much bigger way in terms of deforestation and biodiversity. I think you know, we sitting here in New York, Paris, London, need to realize, like, it's not a problem that's over there. You know, if climate change, you know, if we don't get a handle on climate change, if we don't stop this, you know, biodiversity loss, deforestation, we're all screwed. All, you know, all our lifestyles are going to go away. So I think, and realizing, you know, historically, we've extracted so much wealth from these places that we need to put both the history in perspective and also the hope for a future. And in that way, like, say, yeah, we need to pay the Congolese to keep the rainforests standing. Pay the Indonesians, you know, not so much tell them you need to keep your rainforest standing, but say it's in our interest and we're willing to, you know, negotiate with you so that we can save the planet, basically. Mm. That's the main thing. I think, like, take responsibility both for what's happened historically, you know, and for, like, what we want to happen in the future, and take steps to make it happen in a way that, like, takes into consideration, okay, there are all of those oil palm farmers, and if you're going to, you know, stop growing this much oil palm, you're going to need to help them to transition to something else, help ensure that they have livelihoods. It's complicated. It's very complicated. It's not just like, I'm going to stop using palm oil, right?
Yeah, it really is an issue of equity, right? Like, everyone in the world, you know, needs to be able to live, or else we, you know, if we've created or we have inherited systems in which people are so impoverished that they'll do anything to survive, we can't criticize them for what they do to survive.
Exactly, including cutting down trees and, you know, shooting primates because they're starving for meat.
Mm-hmm. So you end the book talking about a trip, and you're very good at as a travel writer of talking about, like, you took, you know, this was the boat you took and see what you saw on the side. And, like, these are very long trips. As you say, you're going to remote areas. But the last trip you write about, it almost felt like, I don't want to say frivolous, but like extra. Like, you know, you're going to Honduras, you're going to, like, reporting. You go to Lusanga, in the Congo, to look at an art project, and I'm curious what that meant to you.
Well, do you know what Lusanga used to be? You know what Lusanga was called before and after?
No.
It was Lusanga. Then it was Leverville. So it was one of those concessions that William Lever had gone And it was the main place where he had first started growing his palm oil, and when, where he said he built this, you know, utopian village named after himself. So that was Leverville. It's now gone back to Lusanga. And I had read about this because the art project, it's very interesting. There was actually a feature about it and the guy in the New Yorker about 2 months ago. So his whole idea is basically upending, you know, these systems that, that we've been talking about and helping the Congolese to, I mean, he talks about, like, as you said, it's like these people are so poor, they don't even have the luxury to appreciate art. They don't even have, like, art in their lives because they're just basically been abused for centuries and, you know, just getting by. And so what he did was he went to this place, Leverville, now Lusanga, and is helping those artists to get their art out into the world and to make money in order to buy back the land that had been stolen from them centuries ago and get rid of all the oil, the monoculture oil palm plantation and institute sort of agroforestry systems that would help restore the land, help them have healthy diets, help them make money. So it was, it's like more than just an art project. It's much his idea, and this is sort of his life's work, is like, you know, upending this whole colonialist system, system where, you know, part of the world gets to enjoy art and cappuccinos afterward, and all at the expense of these folks who have nothing.
Right. And yeah, I think there's some photos of some of the artworks, and you describe mm-hmm. some of it, that this is, you know, there's a lot of depth and meaning specific, like it's art about this colonial history and what,
exactly,
right, what their parents and grandparents suffered. Right. Like it's very expressive.
Who worked for Lever. Yeah. Yeah. It was really interesting. It was a long ways to get there, but it was fascinating. Yeah. It was a beautiful spot.
So the book's been out for like a year now.
Mm-hmm.
What have you seen it like do in the world?
You know, it's you know, I didn't expect much from it. Frankly, it's done pretty well. It was shortlisted for the Helen Bernstein Award, which is the New York Public Library's award for nonfiction, which was kind of exciting. I, you know, gave it some exposure. I lost to the woman who wrote Invisible Child, as I knew I would. She also won the Pulitzer. But and it got an award from the Society of Environmental Journalists, and another nod from like a Nature Writing award. So, you know, I think those things help, you know, get more readers. But what's been interesting is it keeps getting attention from overseas, which is really gratifying. Like some folks in India, I did a podcast with one or two, and then I think other people saw that. So then they asked me to do a TEDx talk. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so there's that the chapter on public health mm-hmm. is reported from India, mostly about India, because India is the number one importer of palm oil. So anyway, it's you know, it's not a bestseller. Didn't expect it to be, but I think it does seem to continue to get interest from different parts of the world, which is nice. And you know, my hope was just to sort of educate people that this is an issue, and I think that's happening. There was another palm oil book written by a historian at the university. It was published by University of North Carolina Press, I think. It's called The Oil Palm. It's sort of much denser history. It's amazing. It's full of incredible information. But that came out a couple months after mine. So like the London Review of Books, they reviewed the two together, uh-huh. Which was nice. So I think it's like, you know, it's put the topic on people's radars. So that's a nice thing.
Great. Yeah, as I said, you know, first of all, it's so well written.
Thank you.
Just
Miss O'Flaherty.
Well, I don't know that everyone in that class could have written that book. So yeah, I think you're forced to take a little credit. It's a very lively read. It's very literate without being, you know, pedantic. It was just so, you know,
well,
like
that's so nice. Thank you.
like, yeah, it's, I mean, it's like everyone needs to read this book. Like, this is one of the most important books about a topic. And like this, you know, like when I think about the books that I've written, the amount of prep and work that I've done to write them has been so much less. Like, it's just, you know, they're different beasts, but like what you, yeah. like the time, energy, expense, risk you put into this is truly remarkable. And, you know, I'm just so honored to be able to sit here with you and talk about it.
Well, right back at you. I really appreciate your interest. Thank you. Oh, and your good questions.
Yeah. So what are you working on next?
I have a story for Smithsonian Magazine that is overdue. So when I hang up with you, I'm going to go finish that and file that today. It is about, there's a link with the Belgian Congo, but it's not environmental. It's about some women who were basically abducted from they had African mothers and either Congolese or Rwandan mothers and European fathers. And so during the time of the Belgian Congo, you know, it was very regimented racially, with rules for the whites and rules for the blacks. And they weren't supposed to be, you know, having sex basically. And so when these mixed race children were born, they basically abducted them from the houses between the ages of 2 and 4. They were keeping track of them. When they knew that they could go to the bathroom on their own, they took them, and then they brought them to Catholic missions, where these nuns raised them in pretty, like, horrific conditions. The Catholic nuns being paid by the Belgian state to keep these kids. Anyway, so there are these five women who, they're in their 70s now. They were taken, the first one in 1948 up to 1953, and raised in this mission in the Belgian Congo. And they are now suing the Belgian government for crimes against humanity.
Mm.
So that's the story I'm working on. That's why I was in Brussels and Paris.
that's where the records are?
That's where the women are.
Oh, okay.
Well, so it's that. I'm also working on research for a new book, and there's a woman in Paris. It's a biography. The woman is dead, but there's an 83-year-old woman in Paris who knew her. So I've been going back to interview this woman in Paris for that.
Wow. Wow. Yeah, now I remember when we were chatting earlier, I went and read that article.
Fascinating, right?
About the lost children of Spain.
Oh, right. Right. Devastating, isn't it?
My God.
I couldn't believe that article. Yeah. So this one has a lot of this piece, Smithsonian piece, has a lot of sort of echoes of that. Catholic stealing babies.
Yeah, and with, you know, with like the news over the last week, just this question of like, how do people convince themselves to do the things they do, whether it's, you know, the crypto guy or Elizabeth Holmes, like
it's fascinating.
Would I be any different? Like, do I have any, you know, like, am I just fortunate that I was never put in a position where I had to go through those kind of moral gymnastics? Or maybe I have, and I just don't even know it.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Anyway, it's these women are all grandmothers now, and they were like, they had never even told their kids their stories because they were with these nuns, and then independence came, and the nuns and the priests just bailed, and so they left these little girls on their own. So they were at the mercy of you know, militias, and just horrible things happened to them. And so they're very brave. They've told these stories, and their lawyer, who's in Brussels, she also said when they came in and they told their stories, it was the first time, and she said they couldn't even tell their children, and she said, that's the trauma. I saw the same thing, heard about the same thing with the Holocaust, and saw the same thing with the Rwandan genocide. These women could talk about like seeing their husbands murdered and seeing their sons murdered, but they never talked about how they'd been raped and like what happened to them. It's just like, so the same with these women, who, several of whom were also raped. Anyway. Well,
thanks for bringing that to the world.
So I need to go and finish it.
All right. Well, I'll let you go
same,
then.
Same old story with me. I'm thank you for saying my writing is good. It only happens under the, you know, the worst pressure, when the guilt has gotten too much.
Right, right. Yeah, no, deadlines are our nasty friends.
Yeah.
So.
Gotta have them. It's not going to happen otherwise.
Right,
but
so,
generally for me, it happens after the deadline, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, they're out in the world. So. They're making
anyway,
a difference. So thank you so
thank
much.
Thank you, Howie. Lovely to see you.
You too. If people want to follow you and your career and your work, is there a place?
Yeah, my website is jocelynczuckerman.com.
Okay, spell that.
And it's jocelynczuckerman. Okay. And Twitter, I don't tweet that much, but occasionally Jocelyn Zook. Who knows if that'll be there tomorrow anyway, right?
Right. All right, well, we'll find some other place. So,
thank you so much,
Jocelyn. Thank you. Like this really feels like a work of heroism to bring this
thank
to the
you.
World. And I'm so grateful to know you and to be able to follow your work.
Thank you. Same. And I'll see you at the high school reunion next year, right?
All right. Go Cougars.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.
All right. You can check out the show notes for today's episode at plantyourself.com/543. And please go get this book. It is so important. Buy it for your friends who are history buffs. Buy it for your friends who are food buffs or health buffs. This is an important story. And most of it, I was a history major in college, and most of it, almost all of it, was new to me. And this is a story that needs to be told. And if for those of us who can hear it, there are things we can do right now around food politics and food choices to begin to stem the tide. It's not just one of those things where all we have to do is wring our hands. There's a lot of wringing of hands, but there's also voting, organizing, sharing this message, and taking action. All right, so in garden news, garlic's in the ground. I think I mentioned that last week. It got real cold this week, down into the mid-20s, and we're not sure if the cloth row covers that we put are going to be sufficient for the leafy greens. Garlic should be fine under the ground. The Russian kale, the hardiest of the kale, should be fine, but some of the other greens, maybe the broccoli, maybe we didn't protect them good enough. Movement news. I have been running 4 mornings a week, just a 5K. Nice and easy. It's before my foot starts to hurt or anything starts to seize up. And it's better than nothing. And I'm hoping that I'll either stay there or build on it. But it feels like a kind of a small step back in the right direction. Also, I joined a Ultimate Frisbee clinic for adults to learn how to play better. And so that's going to be on Saturday mornings, and our games have shifted to Sunday. So depending on how I'm feeling, I might get twice as much weekend ultimate as I'm getting now. Plus, we're playing Thursday nights under the lights. So it feels like the movement part is pretty much dialed in at this point, as long as I can just stay uninjured. All right, time for thanks. Thanks to Will Ridenour for allowing me to use his beautiful song, Sabali Dawn, The Dance of Peace. You can find more of Will's music at his website, willridenour.com. And of course, thanks to all of you Plant Yourself Podcast patrons, Kim Harrison, Lynn McClellan, Brittany Porter, Dominic Maurer, Barbara Whitney, Tammy Black, Amy Good, Amanda Hatherley, Mary Jane Wheeler, Ellen Kennelly, Melissa Cobb, Rachel Behrens, Tina Scharf, Tina Ahern, Jen Filikanovsky, David Bizek, The Mysterious Michelle X, Elsbeth Feldman, Leah Stoller, Alan Christensen, Colleen Peck, Michelle Landry, Josina, Sarah Durkis, Kelly Cameron, Janet Selby, Claire Adams, Tom Franzek, Jeanette Benham, Gil Assert, David Donahue, Blair Cyborg, Dorona Vizov, Gio and Carolyn Argentati, Jody Friesner, Misha Rosen, Michael Warbeck, Aviva Lael, Alicia Lemus, Val Linneman, Nick Harper, Bandana Chali, Molly Levine, The Inscrutable Harry R., Susan Laverty, The Panda Vegan, Craig Kovic, Adam Scharf, Karen Burry, Heather Morgan, Nigel Davies, Marion Blum, Teresa Koppel, Julian Watkins, Breed O'Connell, Sharon Hirschman, Linda Ayad, Holm Hedegaard, Iza Tuzinwa, Connie Hainline, Aaron Greer, Alicia Davis, Heather O'Connor, Carolyn Jensen, Sherry Olakoski of Plant Power for Health, Karen Smith, Scott Marani, Karen and Joe Crabtree, Kirby Burton, Teresa Carell, Kevin McCauley, Elizabeth Rothschild, Ann Jesse, Cheryl Dwyer, Jenny Hazelton, Peter W. Evans, Dennis Bird, Darby Kelly, Lori Fanny, Linnea Lundquist, Emily Iaconelli, Levy Wallach, Rosamund McAtee, Dan Picorni, Stephen Leenan, Patty DiMartino, Mike and Donna Kartz, Deanne Bishop, Bilberry Elf, Marjorie Lewis, Trisha Adams, Nancy Sheldon, Lindsay Bayshore, Gunmarit Hagen, Tracy Gullidge, Laura Heaton, Meg from Mama Says, Stacey Stokes, Ben Savage, Michael Kay, David Hughes, Connie Rogers, Claire England, Sally Robertson, Paranganchi, Amy Daly, Brian Tourville, Mark Jeffrey Johnson, Josie Dempsey, Karen Schmidt, Pamela Hayden, Emily Perryman, Allison Corbett, Richard Stone, Lauren Vaught of Edible Musings, Aaron Hasty, Sean Owen, Sagar Nayak, Erica Piedra, Danielle Roberts, Michael Lushton, Sarah Johnson, Catherine Floyd, for your generous support of the podcast. That's it for now. As always, be well, my friends. Let's take this home with some gratitudes. First of all, thanks to Mama Earth. You have been so very, very good to me. Second, Will Ridenour donated the use of his beautiful song Sabali Dawn as the theme music for this show. You can find out more about Will's music at willridenour.com. Third, thanks to all the patrons of the Plant Yourself podcast for your financial support. You can read the names of all the patrons at any show notes at plantyourself.com. If you would like to become a patron to show your gratitude for the work I'm doing and help support it, you can do so at plantyourself.com/gift. That's G-I-F-T, all lowercase. And finally, I want to thank you, the listener, for making all of this possible, for giving me a reason to reach out to people, to have conversations, to edit, produce, publicize. All the stuff that I do is for you, so that we can continue to have conversations and continue to ripple out healing and transformation into the world.